Hi, everybody. We're back. This is still Eric Mann with my co-host, Damon Azali. We're happy to have with us today, talking about her new book, Dr. Laura Pulido. The name of her book is Black, Brown, Yellow, and Left, Radical Activism in Los Angeles. How are you, Laura?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you, Eric?
Good. Nice to have you on the show.
Hi, Damon.
Hello.
Laura, I want to sort of start with the end. First of all, you've done a lot of methodology. I mean, your book is based on a lot of interviews with people who have been in the movement in Los Angeles, primarily in the Black, Latino, and Asian Pacific Islander left. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the methodology, and then we'll move to your conclusions.
Well, when I first started trying to understand and examine the third world left, I found out it was this actually huge thing. And so I had to find some kind of way of narrowing down the scope of it so I could ask a specific set of questions as well as kind of, you know, document the lay of the land, what it was like politically at that time. So what I chose to do is I chose to focus on one organization for each of the major racial ethnic groups of that time in Los Angeles, which, as you suggested, were primarily Mexicanos, the, you know, Chicano-Mexicano population, African-Americans, and among Asian-Americans, New America at that time, it was Japanese-Americans who were the largest. And at this time, it's important to remember there was still a lot of more national-specific organizing that was going on. We see a lot more kind of pan, kind of racial or pan-ethnic organizing today, and that wasn't, I think, quite as developed in Los Angeles at that time. So for the Chicano-Mexicano population, I focused on a group called CASA, El Centro de Acción Social y Autónomo, and for African Americans, I examined the Black Panther, the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party, and for Asian Americans, I looked at a group called East Wind, which was actually a collective here in the L.A. area.
And you did a lot. How many interviews did you do total with those three groups?
Oh, a little over 50, probably.
Great. And then you obviously found everybody from people that were generally very supportive of the choices they made to even people who had a lot of either self-criticism or second thoughts. Is that correct?
I found people, yes, but a lot of people who actually did have a lot of criticism or self-doubt weren't always willing to talk to me. So I kind
right.
of have a biased sample somewhere.
Or they were elected officials.
Were there elected officials?
I said, or they were elected
right,
officials
right.
who didn't want to talk to you for reasons. Let's talk about each group very quickly. You went in with some preliminary hypothesis. I know this is hard, but just the goal is to get people interested in this book for them to read it themselves. What would you say is the central conclusion, this is hard, but of take each group, and what would you say, let's start with its contribution to history.
The contribution to history. I'll start with the Panther Party. And it's, I should point out that when I started doing this, I really didn't want to even do the Panther Party because there has been a fair amount of work done on the Panther Party. And I kind of want to explore another part of, like, African-American radicalism here in Los Angeles. But I quickly found out that the Panther Party was just so central to all of the left radical activity on the part of all people here in L.A. at that time. And one might even say nationally, but I'm just going to stick with Los Angeles in terms of my claims. So that's one of the huge things about the Panther Party, is it created the space for other groups to mobilize. And that is just cannot be overestimated, you know, very, very important. The other thing about the Panther Party that's important is that it focused primarily on trying to serve the most marginalized, oppressed segments of the African-American population, which much of the civil rights movement had kind of overlooked. In the kind of claims that they were making, efforts that they were trying to mobilize in the legislature and stuff. So that was very important. Real focus on terms of redistribution, focus on the local police, focus on trying to, you know, get power at the urban community level for poor and impoverished African Americans.
And staying on the Panthers before we move, you seem to be ambivalent about their armed struggle strategies and tactics and the impact on the organization. And again, sort of dividing one into two, do you think there was a contribution in that direction? And then secondly, what is your main criticism?
Yeah, I definitely do think there was a contribution in that direction. I think because, you know, by advocating, arming themselves and self-defense, that was enormously important in terms of taking on the state. It was really important in terms of getting people to understand you can challenge the state, which before people had said they just assumed that they can't. I mean, some of the quotes I have from former Panthers are really great, just saying, you know, we just always assumed we had to take the shit that was doled out to us, you know, from the cops, from the judges, from whatever. We never thought we could do anything more than challenge them in this way. So that was enormously, enormously empowering. And also really scared, and I think this is a positive thing. I think it scared a lot of people across the United States, especially white people, but all kinds of people. And I think people needed to be scared to a certain extent. You know, the kind of racial dynamic of this country had to change, and it was changing, and that being frightened was part of the process. Here's what black folks could do when they mobilized together. And this, it was really more the threat that they posed than actually what they did, I think, you know, in terms of their armed struggle. But that was enormously important, I'd say.
And then we're going to move quickly. We have about 10 more minutes, and I want to make sure you score a lot of points. You're doing great. Let's move now to what you think your main criticism is that you got out of the research and, of course, ultimately your own political assessment.
Out of the Panthers or the research?
Panthers. We're going to stay with the Panthers first.
One of the criticisms of the Panthers that it was, it took a very, very heavy toll on a lot of the individuals involved. Having said that, there's a lot of people that have gone on to have really great careers and great political lives based on that initial kind of political mobilization in the Panthers, but there's so many other people that are not, that are dead, that are in prison, or are actually what I call them are kind of the walking wounded. They are very, very marginalized. They don't have economic resources, marketable skills, sometimes physical wounds because of the altercations that they had with the police and the struggles that they had, and there really is no way of caring for those people. So it really took an enormous toll on them also.
Okay. Now, CASA, which seriously many elected or several progressive elected officials were members of at the time, I was with, as you know, the August 29th movement, which had a different line on the Chicano national question. The ATM thought that Chicanos in the United States represented a separate nationally formed people in alliance with the Mexicans, whereas CASA had what was called the Sin Fronteras view, essentially, that saw the Mexican community both inside and outside the United States in a more integral way. What did you think was its primary contribution when you studied its history? Let's start with that.
I think one of the great contributions of CASA was it reinserted for the larger Chicano-Mexicano population in this country the importance of workers, and in particular reconnecting us also to think about our brothers and sisters across that line, that to think about them as workers and all of us as one working class. I certainly didn't agree with their position that there is no such thing as, you know, as a Chicano population or the importance of the Southwest. That's, for me as a Chicana, it's very important to my political thinking and ideology. But nonetheless, I think that was a tremendous contribution to reinsert the importance of labor and class.
And they were good organizers too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they actually did it. Right? And then I know one of your themes throughout, so I don't want to bring it on just one group, but I know one of your themes is the treatment of women and the concept of women's liberation versus male chauvinism at that point in history. So I don't want to put it on any one of the groups, but do you want to maybe discuss that as maybe a cross-cutting theme?
Yeah. Gender relations were very problematic across all of the third world groups, all the organizations that I looked at, but in very different kinds of ways and to a different extent within the various groups. The Panthers are particularly interesting, I think, because oftentimes they are portrayed as this kind of misogynist organization that just oppressed women. Well, there's elements of that. It also provided tremendous opportunities for mobility for women and opportunities for kind of political development and leadership opportunities, such as Elaine Brown, for example.
Right.
CASA, on the other hand, was kind of an extreme example in the other direction. It was actually some of the most oppressive towards women, partly because it adhered, I believe, to a very strict kind of Marxist theoretical position in which that privileged what they called the objective over the subjective. And the subjective kind of included all those realms of personal issues like, you know, childcare, romance, sexual relations, and things like that. And the organization was never really able to talk about that. And then in contrast, there's East Wind, which actually had some of the most progressive gender relations of all the organizations. And I think that one of the reasons East Wind did is, for one, it didn't adhere to a really kind of rigid ideology, which kind of would have precluded them from addressing cultural issues. But they also saw, and I think this might have been kind of, you know, drawing from the political climate of the day, they saw cultural change and everyday change as part of the revolutionary process. Right. So revolution, it doesn't just take place out there. It also takes place with me and as well as within my collective and in my personal relations. So they were much more open to experimenting, it seems to me, with different types of gender relations.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, do you think, and I'm going to make my opinion and then my question, that the way you said it was that because of Casas, Marxism, they essentially, you know, took the so-called subjective factor, which is not inherent in Marxism to mean that people's feelings, thoughts, relationships are subordinate to material conditions. And, you know, you felt that there was the theory that led to the male supremacy. But then let's take August 29th movement, which was even more Marxist influence than CASA, right? It was an explicitly Marxist-Leninist organization. And my wife, Leanne, Hearst Mann's view, who came out of the Berkeley-Oakland Women's Union, is that ATM was the most women's liberation organization and a League of Revolutionary Struggle that she'd ever been in, that there was both good policies on child care and enforced policies on child care. So even if you weren't good on it, you did it. There was tremendous promotion of women into leadership, a pretty principled and not ultra-left struggle against male supremacy. I'm not saying, you know, but, you know, as an example, we just raised a bunch of children for 7 or 8 years with a great deal of love and attention. So I just think, you know, well, we really loved each other's children, not just took care of each other's children. So I'm asking you, do you think that the problem resides in Marxism inherently, which is fine if you do, or in Casas' particular application of it?
No, I'm really glad you gave ATM as an example because it's important for two ways. I think, first of all, to answer your question, yes. In the case of CASA, it was a particular interpretation that they used, which is very, very problematic. And actually, there's lots of examples we could point to within CASA of interpretations which were problematic, but that would be the most glaring was gender. They chose to represent it. They chose to understand and implement in a particular way. The second thing that ATM is important is because oftentimes when I, like, would tell people about this, they'd point out, well, CASA, oh, it's a Chicana group. Oh, they're Mexicanos. Of course, they're all a bunch of, machismos over there.
Right.
You know, what do you expect? And again, we can point to ATM as an example because it was a primarily Chicano organization,
yes,
not exclusively, and had a very different kind of political culture. So I think ATM is a really good counter to that, to show that was a particular manifestation in CASA.
No, I think that's really, we could spend a lot, because I think, you know, given that every culture, I'm Jewish, and every culture, if you're in your own culture, you're so aware of its problems, right? I mean, you love your own culture, but you often can need to be your own critic. But the many forms of racism, and one is the reduction of Latinos to machismo, you know, as a white racist concept, right? And the reduction, therefore, and obliteration of women's role in the entire, I mean, which is crazy. I mean, women, if you look at Latino, Chicano, Mexicano history, women are so important in that culture. And as if there's a specificity to Latin culture about machismo as opposed to what? Cornell University?
Right. We have a monopoly on it.
Right. So it's good we both, you know, raised that. Now let's go back to East Wind. How are we doing? In East Wind, what was the primary, was it Japanese-American?
Yes.
It was, right? And what was their fight with the so-called model minority, right? I mean, because obviously when I joined the League of Revolutionary Struggle, we merged with Iwar Kyun, which is predominantly Chinese, but all Asian Pacific Islander. And there was a lot of discussion there about how their fight with the racist stereotype was, you're the model minority, why are you giving us so much trouble, right?
Mm-hmm.
So was that discussion happening inside of East Wind, and how did they deal with essentially that stereotype?
It absolutely was a very big part of East Wind, and it was a major point of mobilization for the group. They attracted people. We have to remember at this time, this is just the moment when Asian Americans are really beginning to identify as Asian Americans versus as Orientals, and trying to understand their place within the larger racial formation, and understanding that they oftentimes are seen as the model minority and used against other people of color. So in East Wind, as in many other kind of revolutionary Asian American organizations at the time, they take a very strong position that we are not going to be used as a tool to further oppress other people of color, particularly African Americans. And in fact, it is incumbent upon us to articulate a very different kind of racial identity, one that stands in solidarity with other people of color. And this becomes a very a focal point, really, of their work. They do more than any other group. East Wind does a lot of inter-ethnic solidarity work, reaching out to other communities of color, trying to find connections with CASA around immigration issues, as well as many other Chicano groups, and the same with the African Americans, American Indians. They're there all the time in solidarity. For them, it's part of a way of saying we are not going to be that model minority, and we are, in fact, people of color in solidarity with you.
Well, Laura, we could go on. Somebody just sent me a nice note saying I could listen to Eric and Laura talk for a long time. So, and you and I have talked for a long time, for about over 15 years. Many things else I'd like to discuss with you about the book. You end with the discussion of dogmatism, coerciveness, and sectarianism, and the struggle against orthodoxy. I'd like to maybe put that on the table. But the main thing is you wrote it. As an author, I can tell you the most important thing is you did your research, made your conclusions, put them in writing, which isn't easy. The book is published by UC Press, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very nice. They did a nice job. Available in bookstores, available at Amazon, right?
Yes.
And
SO1 also.
And at SO1. And thank you so much, Loud. It's great to have you.
Okay. Take care. See you on May 1st.
Absolutely.
Bye.